It's real, all right. She took a deep breath. It happened like this, she said, and spun a tale of monsters who ate children and childhood dreams, including Leslie's puppy, and a fierce old woman who knew a little of the Fae, and about a debt owed and a bargain made. You can use it to fix your daughter's knee? Leslie asked. Bokler shook his head and handed the card back to Leslie. No, but I'll remember you offered. And I'll give you some advice, if you don't mind. The Fae who gave that to you did it with the best of intentions. For all that we do not reproduce, we tend to be a very long-lived people. Trasac was very old and powerful, too. But death comes for us all eventually, and it came to him. Leslie tucked the card away and rubbed her eyes with the edge of her finger so her makeup wouldn't run. I don't know why I'm feeling this way. It's stupid. I met him once for less than 10 minutes, and I won't forget him. No, agreed Bokler gravely. Trasac was a marvel. Poet, fighter, joyful companion, and there are no more of his like to be found. None of us will forget him. Fey magic, though, sometimes has a mind of its own. That was given to you to resolve a debt. He intended it to be a gift and a blessing. But his death means that his will no longer binds that bit of magic. Use it or not as you wish, but use it for a small thing, or for something that equals the grief of a good man who could not spare a child the pain of her puppy's fate. If you remember his exact words, use it for that. By his words and by the debt, this magic is tamed. Go beyond those things with your wish, and it will cause havoc of an unpleasant kind. Do you have healers? Anna asked. Healing is among the great magics, and we have very few healers left among us, and most of them are even less trustworthy than Trasac's gift would be. He took a drink of his beer and nodded to Leslie. My daughter will walk again, but she will not dance. It is the way of mortals. They fling themselves at life and emerge broken. She survived, said Anna. She's tough. She fought them every step of the way. She'll make it. Bokler nodded politely. Some mortals do. Some of them make it just fine when horrible things happen to them. Some of them... He shook his head and took another sip of his beer and then said with quiet savagery, sometimes broken people stay broken. He looked at her. Why am I telling you all of this? Anna shrugged. People talk to me. She didn't know what else to say, so she followed her impulse. I've been where Lizzie is, brutalized and terrified. Someone rescued me before my captors were able to kill me. Next to that, losing something she loves is tragic, but she doesn't seem to be the kind who will think that she would be better off dead. Not in the long run. Bokler looked at his glass. I'm sorry to hear that you had to be rescued. She shrugged again. That which does not destroy us makes us stronger, right? It came out sounding flippant, so she added, I knew a woman when I was in school. She was smart, a talented musician, and hardworking. She came to college and found out that those weren't enough to make her a first violin, or even a second. And she tried to kill herself because she had to sit with the third violins. It was the first real disappointment she'd ever had in her life, and she didn't know how to deal with it. Those of us who live in the real world and survive horrible things, we emerge stronger and ready to face tomorrow. Lizzie will be okay. Bokler frowned at her. He looked away and then said, You might visit her and tell her that. She didn't want to. She wasn't a counselor, and she didn't like talking about what had happened to her to strangers, though it hadn't stopped her tonight, had it? Anna was okay because Charles found her and taught her to be strong. Lizzie would have to find her own strength, and Anna didn't know how to tell her where to find it. I'll see what I can do, she promised reluctantly. She was exhausted from being on display and from thinking about things she'd tried to put behind her. If you'll excuse me, I think I'll go visit the ladies' room. She left Leslie talking to the Fae and let herself out of the banquet room. Away from the noise and the room full of mostly strangers, Anna felt better. She'd use the restroom, eat the food she'd ordered, and go home. When she came out of the restroom, she wasn't pleased to see that Agent Hoyter was leaning against the wall next to the door. There was no one left in the restaurant proper. It must have closed at 10. So she and Hoyter were alone in the hallway next to the entrance for the room where the party was still going strong. So you are the heroine of the day, he said. Something in his voice didn't track, and she frowned at him. Not really, no. If you'll excuse me? But he stepped in front of her. No, I don't think so. Not today. And someone who wasn't there grabbed her from behind and sent her to sleep. Chapter 11. Anna woke with a sickly sweet taste in her mouth that spread into her nose and up through her sinuses, deadening anything else her nose might tell her. Nausea and a rotten headache vied with the silver collar and high silver content medieval-style cuffs and chains for the honors of the most miserable distractions. Anna tried to remember what had happened that had left her chained up like someone's extreme BDSM fantasy in a human-sized cage that hung in a large empty room. It was dark, and she was all alone. She'd been talking to Hoyter, who'd been acting weird, and then, geez, had they really chloroformed her? Decades-long killing spree, witches' magic, rare old scary fae bloodlines, and they used chloroform. Several times, if her vague memories of waking up in the backseat of a car were accurate. That just seemed so mundane. She rose to her hands and knees, and that was as far as the chains would let her go. She let the burn of the silver and the desperate need to upchuck her dinner keep her from panic as she tried to think around the headache for a plan of attack. Lizzie had been raped within hours of when they took her. It was almost the first thing that they had done. And that was the thought that made Anna throw up. As delicious as the food in Isaac's Irish pub had been, it didn't taste very good the second time around. She managed to get most of it out of the cage, but enough lingered on her hair. For some reason, having her hands cuffed and chained had impeded her ability to keep her hair out of her mouth, and had splattered on the edge of the floor that it added to her misery. And then she wondered if she was as alone in the room as she had thought. She hadn't been able to see or smell the Fae who'd been guarding Lizzie's prison on the island. Panic threatened, and she forced it down, because it wouldn't do her any good. Charles would be looking for her by now. But when she tried their bond, it was closed as tight as it ever had been. Didn't he know she was missing? Isaac would tell him right away. But what if Isaac didn't know? What if Hoyter told him that Anna had decided to go back to the condo on her own? But that didn't make sense, because Isaac would be able to tell Hoyter was lying. And Hoyter knew that. He'd have to stay as far out of the way as he could so he didn't give himself away to the werewolves. So why hadn't Charles opened the bond between them? There was noise outside the cavernous room, and Anna crouched low, trying to quiet her breathing and slow down her pounding heart so she could hear through the closed doors and the walls. They were talking pretty loudly, so it wasn't too hard to get most of it.
Pretty one, I like the women and the pretty ones best. I thought you had decided you were a superhero, Bulldog.
Hoyter's voice was mocking.
It pays well, the stranger said. Better than janitorial work. Never got a blowjob for cleaning a floor. Got one for saving that hooker from her pimp. This one we got now is pretty, isn't she pretty?
Not as pretty as the one you let get away, said Hoyter.
Not my fault, not my fault, that big wolf. He was gonna kill me.
There was an edge of hysteria in the man's voice, and an odd cadence to his speech pattern.
You never said they'd have a monster with them. Killing werewolves isn't hard. I killed all of them Uncle Travis sent me. Why is that one so hard to kill?
The witch did something, said Hoyter. Used some kind of magic so the wolf could see you, and it must have made him stronger. The girl we got tonight is his wife.
He's gonna be so mad at me.
He sounded scared. Hoyter headed it off at the pass. He has to find us first. This will be the last one for the year, and then we'll move on.
I get her first, said the man, who wasn't Hoyter.
Anna was pretty sure that Hoyter was not the Fae. Surely Bokler would have been able to tell if he had been. She decided that the other man must be the Fae. Neither of them sounded old, and Lizzie had told them that one man was older. And if Anna decided one of the speakers was the Fae, no unseen person could be watching her from the shadows.
I get her first because that wolf hurt me. I get to hurt her. I'm gonna take her until she understands who's boss.
He continued in that vein, working himself into a frenzy as he used fouler and fouler language to describe her fate in ugly detail. Anna deliberately tuned him out. She'd learned how to do that shortly after she'd been changed, and there had been no Charles to save her from the crazy bastards in the broken Chicago pack. She couldn't feel Charles. He was going to be too late, and that would destroy him. She tugged on the chains, but they'd held werewolves before, and there was no way she could break them. Blowing on her hands to ease the burn, she thought about how Isaac had said that his wolf, Otten, had been waiting for a chance, and the killers hadn't given him one. She couldn't afford to wait. She had to make her own chance. Because Anna had been a victim once upon a time, and she was damned sure never going to be one again. Despite her determination, she was scared. Her chances weren't good. These men had managed to kill a lot of people, werewolves and fae. Some of them considerably more experienced at protecting themselves than she was. The sick, acrid smell of her terror burned out the last of the chloroform from her nose, and she grabbed her fear, the lingering pain of the headache, and the ache that was seeping into her muscles from the silver. She pitted it all against the metal cuffs that held her, neck, wrists, and ankles, and called on the change. These were not a pack of werewolves. They were human and fae. Raping Anna when she was a wolf was an entirely different proposition from doing the same to her when she didn't have freakishly sharp teeth and claws that would be a credit to any cougar on the planet. The change always hurt. Always. And she'd long ago learned to use the pain to bully her way through the freaky feeling of her bones stretching and bunching, of muscles growing and teeth sharpening, that was so much more intolerable than mere pain. This time, the change was worse than usual. Her throat buckled under the pressure of the silver collar. Then it rehealed and buckled again, trapped inside a metal band that was too small to contain it. She thought she just stymied her kidnappers by killing herself, when something in the more fragile mechanism of the lock finally broke, sending a piece of metal flying. The collar fell away from her, hitting the floor and bits of chain with a harsh clank. Sucking in air like a bellows, she still had to hold on to her thoughts and make her arms, that were becoming her front legs, move at just the right time, while her hands were still hands, but after her arms had slightly reshaped in order to get out of the wrist manacles. Her wrists bled, and she panted, trying to keep quiet, as she dragged herself free of the 2-inch-wide silver bands that imprisoned her. She didn't worry about the cuffs on her ankles, because they were wider, and the wolf would just step out of them. She waited, but there was no pause in the conversation outside. Either they were too involved to notice, they expected her to be making some noise, or their ears were too human to hear through the walls the way she could hear them. She lay spent for a moment, then realized that moment was dragging on into the next without any further change happening. Dangerous to stay half-shifted, though some of the most dominant wolves could do it for a while. She scrambled for a way to continue the change, but her body was exhausted, shaking with the need for food, and they had doped her up with something. Mostly, werewolves were immune to drugs and alcohol. Their metabolism just ran through it too fast. But they had given her something, probably a whole lot of something. GHB, or Rohypnol, maybe, or some sedative designed to keep her passive. It had been no match for the adrenaline surge that the thought of being helpless in the hands of rapists and murderers had brought. But it had stalled out her shift. Pain came in waves, because her body wasn't meant to be caught between for this long. Fluids, clear, pink, and bright red, began to leak onto the floor of the cage. She reached out for Charles and found the moon instead. Tomorrow would come the night of the full moon, when her song was too strong to resist. But tonight she was waxing and full of strength that she lent to her daughter, who asked. With a painful jerkiness that scraped chain and manacles loudly on the bottom of the cage as her muscles flexed and tore and reshaped themselves, Anna restarted her change. Charles was deep into his work. Brother Wolf loved the hunt, even when it was on computers instead of in flesh and blood. Both of them could smell their prey, weak and quivering just out of their reach. So the first knock on the door elicited no more than a growl of annoyance. It was Brother Wolf who noticed something was wrong the second time the knock came. Even buried in the endgame of his hunt, his senses were still on alert. And they told Brother Wolf that the smart FBI lady, the smart FBI man who tried very hard to be underestimated, the Fae whose daughter had been hurt, and the local Alpha were knocking on his door. And they were all supposed to be with his mate, who was not here.
Anna.
Charles reached for her, but he couldn't touch her through their bond, not even through their pack bond. With his help, his ghosts had well and truly isolated him. Enraged and terrified for Anna in equal measures, he opened the door knowing his eyes were showing Brother Wolf.
Where's Anna? He growled.
Isaac was supposed to make sure no one hurt her while Charles worked. The temptation to blame the old town Alpha rose and was banished. Anna was Charles's. She was his to protect, and he had failed. Brother Wolf wanted to charge into the night and kill until they found her. Charles held him back with the knowledge that there were better ways to find Anna faster, and that blood would flow when he did.
We were hoping you could tell us, Isaac said. She went to the ladies' room and never came back. You two are mated, right? Can you tell where she is?
Charles tried again. Right there and then, with the others still standing in the doorway, he tried again to open up the bonds he'd closed to protect her. Nothing. He tried harder, tried until it hurt worse than the change. He growled and tried again, and felt the ghosts who haunted him howl in triumph. He turned and walked almost blindly until he stared into the big mirror in the bedroom. The ghosts were unrecognizable, having melted into one creature with 50 mouths and 20 hands that were busily tying the ribbon of his bond into knots.
We can kill her, no matter how you try to protect her, it told him, its voices high and vicious. Your fault. Your fault we died. Your fault she dies.
One voice started laughing, and then the others continued until there was an unholy cacophony in his head. There was a drip of blood leaking out of Charles's nose, and the whites of his eyes were pink from broken blood vessels. It made his yellow eyes look particularly bizarre.
Did you try to track her?
He asked Isaac, as Charles continued to stare into the mirror, his voice so low and rough he didn't recognize it as his own. He stuffed his rage into a small, icy place and promised it release if it would let him work right now. He would be cold and controlled until he found where they had stashed his Anna. And then he'd take them down into small, bite-sized chunks.
Yes,
the old town alpha said. Charles turned away from the mirror to find Isaac watching him warily from the relative safety of the living room as he continued to explain.
I trailed her into the ladies' room and out again. Then she walked about 2 feet the wrong way if she intended to go back into the party, which she did because she'd ordered another round of fish and chips according to the waitress who delivered it, and then her scent trail just ends. Like Otten's did.
Isaac must be a good tracker. It was unusual for a wolf that new to be able to trail that well, even in wolf form. No matter how good he was, Charles was better. The computer hadn't confirmed his guesses yet, but he was only waiting for the final nail. He considered going after the people he had decided were behind the killings. But if he was wrong, it meant Anna would stay in her kidnapper's hands while he chased down the wrong trail. And then there was the problem that the people he was looking at had nearly Brand's resources, and he would need...
What's wrong with him?
Leslie asked in a quiet voice that nonetheless interrupted his thoughts.
Why is he bleeding like that? Do you see his eyes?
They weren't like that when he opened the door.
I don't have a clue, Isaac said in a calm voice. Look, you two don't stand a chance if he loses it. You stay out here, back, out of the way. Keep your guns out and watch. If he looks like he is headed your way, just shoot and make sure your shot counts. If he's the wolf I think he is, he'd rather be dead than have you become collateral damage. And if he's far enough gone that he's taken out civilians, he's not going to be much help to Anna anyway.
Civilians? Said the male FBI officer, sounding offended. Brother Wolf might have known his name if he had cared, but his mate was missing, and he cared for nothing and no one except for that. Isaac ignored him. Maybe he'd fallen for that tired, worn-looking mien, but Brother Wolf knew better. He recognized a fellow predator in the male FBI agent. Even though Goldstein, the name rose up when he called for it, Goldstein was no threat to anything Charles cared about.
Humans are civilians here, said Charles.
To himself, he sounded calm.
And you might listen to Isaac, though I don't think I'm far enough gone to hurt our allies. Isaac, I should be able to find her, but I'm not going to be able to use our link tonight.
His throat shut down as Brother Wolf fought to the surface in a panic at Charles's admission. Anna was missing. Anna was in the hands of the people who'd hurt the little dancer, his Anna, who'd already survived so much. He'd sworn nothing like that would ever happen to her again when she was theirs. And they had failed. Brother Wolf and Charles, two souls sharing one skin, they had failed their mate. Charles convinced Brother Wolf that they had a better chance of finding Anna in man shape rather than as wolf. But it took more willpower than he knew he had to do it.
He can't find her? Leslie asked.
I told you it wasn't a sure thing, Isaac told her. The mating bond is a very personal thing.
Isaac was doing a good job of keeping his alpha nature tamped down. His voice was soft and non-threatening. Brother Wolf liked Isaac, but just now would not be a good time to interest him in proving who was more dominant. People got killed in fights like that, and Brother Wolf was craving violence just now.
You also said if it didn't work, we might be in serious trouble, said the tough little dancer's fey father, because there isn't a person in this city more dangerous than a wolf whose mate is in danger. Are we in serious trouble?
Yes, thought Charles. He needed to do something urgent, but Brother Wolf's rage was clouding his thoughts. He needed to get to his computer and confirm.
I don't want those bastards to get Anna, Leslie said. If Charles can't find her, what about my wish? You said it was dangerous to use except in specific or small ways, but I lost a puppy, and now we're trying to find another one.
Charles narrowed his eyes at her.
What wish?
Beauclerk ignored him, staring at Leslie with something approaching delight.
Clever, he said. Oh, that is a clever way to look at it.
A fey man left me a gift when I was a child, Leslie said to Charles, and she remembered not to look him in the eyes. To make up for not being there to rescue my puppy, I think. I've never used it, and our expert in fey magic says that I need to be careful with it. But that sounds like a fair exchange to me.
She looked at Beauclerk. Gravely, he nodded. I think that might be right.
She opened her purse and took out her wallet, and Charles could smell the magic from where he stood. Fey magic, strong enough to make him sneeze, powerful enough to give him hope. She pulled out a little white card from her billfold.
I'm not exactly sure how to do this.
Magic follows intention, said Charles, and Beauclerk gave him a sharp look. Tell it what you want, and tear up the card to seal the deal.
Since when did the Maroc's son become an expert in fey magic? Asked Beauclerk, and Charles saw Goldstein look very bland. It was the Maroc's son that had done it.
Goldstein had heard that term before, and now wanted to know what it meant.
Since when did the fey give up information on the werewolves?
Countered Charles silkily. Anna was missing. He didn't care what Goldstein found out. But the fey would do very nicely to sate Brother Wolf's desire to tear into flesh until it bled. Beauclerk, Brother Wolf decided, would be a worthy opponent. And once he killed something, maybe he could think clearly again. Beauclerk took a cautious step back, and Isaac eased between them.
You don't want to do anything rash, Charles, he cautioned. We're all on the same team here.
I wish, said Leslie, drawing Charles's attention away from the fey. I wish, she looked at Charles, one lost puppy for another, but Anna is yours as Toby was mine. So I wish that as I lost my puppy, my dog that I loved, that Charles should find his lost wolf.
She tore the card in half, and the magic did something. Charles's phone rang before he could figure out what the magic had done. Its sudden, blaring ringtone that wasn't the song it sang when Anna called him irritated Brother Wolf, who pulled it out of their pocket and crushed it to make it stop. Everyone in the condo quit breathing, and Charles realized that his ability to speak coherently had apparently given them a false sense of safety.
How long until it works?
He asked Beauclerk. In a soft, soft voice. The fey sighed.
We don't even know it will work, werewolf.
Something happened, but it wasn't my magic in that card.
Trasac tended towards subtle magic that snuck up behind you.
Another cell phone rang and Charles growled. Isaac pulled out his phone and started to hit the off button, but paused.
406 is the Montana area code, right?
He answered the phone before Charles replied, and clear as day, Charles's father's voice came out of the speaker of Isaac's phone.
I have a feeling that my son is in a bad place, Bran said, and I have made a habit of not ignoring my feelings, especially
when neither he nor Anna are answering their phones. Isaac gave Charles a nervous glance.
That's right. Charles is here and Anna's been taken by the murdering bastards we've been chasing. We have the FBI here, the two who've been working with us. And Boakler is present as well, the Fae whose daughter we rescued yesterday.
It was a very good rundown of what was happening, Charles thought.
Why isn't Charles chasing down Anna?
Brother Wolf growled.
That's not helpful, Charles, Bran said.
He says he can't contact her.
There was a very long pause, and then his father said quietly,
Charles, is it the same thing that was bothering you before you went to Boston?
Charles couldn't answer, wasn't human enough to answer. He turned around and stalked to the far side of the room. If he hadn't killed them, hadn't executed those wolves in Minnesota, he'd have been able to find Anna before she got hurt.
Before Boston, said Isaac, and his voice trailed off. Oh, I know what you did before Boston, Charles. This could get messy,
he said to the others, suddenly decisive.
I think we can work something out, but it might be better if you people who are a little too easy to hurt are out of the way. Would you mind waiting in the hall?
You have something to talk about that you don't want us to hear, said Goldstein. You don't have to lie. We'll go wait.
I never lie to the cops or the FBI,
Isaac said. He was being truthful, Charles noted, somewhat absently.
Things might get pretty bad before they get better, and I don't want you hurt.
Isaac didn't say anything to Boakler, but the Fae said, I think I'll wait outside with the others. He'll be easier without me here. There was a quiet click as his front door was shut, and another as Isaac threw the deadbolt.
All right,
Isaac said, and it took a moment for Charles to realize he was talking to Bran.
It's just Charles and me, though Boakler here is just fine. He might be able to hear every word we say.
Acceptable, said Charles's Da crisply. Boakler is trustworthy, and he owes us a debt if you've rescued his daughter.
Trust Da to know Boakler.
Fine,
said Isaac.
So, am I reading this right? And there's something about that
He caught himself, probably remembering someone warning him not to swear around Bran. Charles's father was old, and though he could swear with the best of them, usually in Welsh, he generally preferred to avoid it. He could get pretty scary with underlings who had foul mouths.
Isaac continued with slightly milder adjectives.
Screwed up thing in Minnesota that Charles got stuck with that is somehow interfering with his bond with Anna?
I don't know, said Bran. Charles, is that what the problem is?
Charles didn't know Isaac well, and talking in front of him was akin to dancing naked in public. But if his father could figure out a way to help, and if he couldn't, then no one could, then he would have stripped off his clothes and run naked down Congress Street in downtown Boston at lunch hour, just to get a chance to talk with him.
They've broken the link, Charles said.
Who has?
Asked Bran.
The ghosts of the people I've killed, who should have lived.
He turned to look at his father, but all he saw was Isaac, holding his cell phone open. He smiled grimly at Isaac, who took a step back, and spoke to him.
Another man would probably have a mental breakdown and blame all sorts of psychoses. But my grandfather was a shaman, and he gave me the gift that allows me to see the ghosts of those I've wronged.
So they're haunting you,
Isaac said, his face quiet. Charles hadn't expected the Alpha to get in his face and call him a liar.
Charles was the Maroc's hatchet man, after all.
But the simple belief he saw made him remember that Isaac's grandfather could see ghosts, too.
And they are haunting me, he said,
Brother Wolf standing down a little from immediate attack. Brother Wolf approved of Isaac, as long as the other wolf didn't get too pushy.
Tell him why,
Bran said into the silence. His voice was odd, as it got when he was following an impulse he didn't understand. The truth was, Charles got his ability to deal with magic from both halves of his heritage, but it sometimes bothered Bran when magic spoke to him, probably because Bran's mother had made the Wicked Witch of the West look like Cinderella's fairy godmother.
Because my guilt holds them here,
Charles answered Isaac, because Bran thought it might be important.
They should be off wherever dead people go, but I'm holding them here because I can't let them go.
You feel guilty about what?
Isaac asked, sounding honestly bewildered.
We all know about Minnesota.
No one gossips like us alphas.
Three wolves killed some old pedophile, half ate him, and then left him for the civilians to find. And it was some 10-year-old kid who found him.
Probably taking into account what the gossip says and the police reports I saw, the 10-year-old was the kid the old guy was after. The damn fools probably made so much noise fighting over the body that the kid came to investigate. At least they had the sense to run instead of killing the kid. But I think they racked up enough stupidity to register on the top 5 dumbass moves list for the next 10 years or so.
Charles hadn't known that it had been the child who found the body. His father had told him that his job was to go find out if they had killed the man and left him for humans to find. And if so, execute them. Brother Wolf had forced their confession. Dominant wolves can do that if they are more dominant enough. And then carried out his alpha's orders.
Poor boy, murmured Bran. No one told me it was the boy who found him.
Someone, Charles knew, would contact the boy's family and make sure he got counseling. His parents would think it some sort of victims organization or something. It was one of the jobs Charles used to handle or oversee.
You feel guilty for executing them, Isaac said,
dragging Charles's attention back to him.
I get that, but I don't get why you should.
Were they crying like babies?
Because that really sucks when they do that. Was it Robert, their alpha? I heard that garbage he was passing around. Their victim was a bastard who deserved to die. Fine. If they were sure he was guilty, kill him somewhere quietly and get rid of the body. If you ask me, I'd have executed their alpha too for being incompetent enough to let them get so out of control that they left him for civilians to find.
Had this happened before we came out, Charles said, I could have let them live.
Could you?
Isaac said. He shook his head. If they'd been in my pack, I'd have killed them. Now, 10 years ago, whenever. Charles read the truth of that in Isaac's voice.
It didn't matter to them that the guy was dirt, Isaac said. If they were after a righteous kill, they wouldn't have eaten him. If they hadn't been hunting in a pack, they probably wouldn't have killed him either. They were dumbasses. They were out of control. And you can't have dumbass, out-of-control werewolves. Not now, not ever. And it was their alpha's job to make sure they weren't dumbasses. I know better than to send a pack out hunting when we don't want a bloody mess to result, and I haven't been a werewolf half as long as Robert has been alpha of his pack. And he couldn't accept the blame. Oh, no. They were the good guys. He wasn't gonna kill the good guys. Because he knows it was his fault they needed to be killed in the first place. So Bran must send you out to kill them. I bet that
He cast a panicked glance at the phone and bit his lip and finished more quietly.
I bet he said all the right things, all the polite things, and still made you feel like a murderer, right? He did it because he knows it's his fault, and he can't admit it to himself, so he's looking for someone to blame. And they all know, we all know, that right now, we werewolves cannot afford headlines like we've been seeing in Minnesota.
It was truth, as Isaac felt it. And it sounded right. Maybe he'd been listening too hard to Robert and not thinking clearly. Charles took a deep breath.
Anna knows how people work, he said. She'd have seen it too. But I don't bring Anna with me anymore.
It makes sense, though, right? Isaac said.
If you weren't already worn down with the killing, said Bran heavily, you would have recognized the truth yourself.
If I weren't so busy trying to justify something that has less to do with justice than expedience, I would have seen it too.
Just because it was necessary doesn't mean that it wasn't the right answer anyway.
One of the wolves had been a wolf for less than 2 years, Charles said.
Too bad for them, said Isaac. They chose to give in to the wolf at the wrong time. They chose to hang out with idiots. They chose to act as they did. They chose their own death, and you were just the delivery system.
I think, said Bran, that the Minnesota pack needs a different alpha.
Agreed, said Isaac.
Charles, said Bran, where is Anna?
He pointed southwest, unaware until he did so of how accurate a fix he had on her.
10 miles that direction.
He couldn't tell anything else, couldn't touch her mind, but he knew where she was.
Find her, his father told him, and take these people down. Avoid killing them if you can. Remind your wolf that jail is a much worse sentence than death. If we can help take them down with minimal violence, that would be good.
Yes,
agreed Charles, though his Da had already disconnected.
Are you all right?
Asked Isaac.
Charles gave him a shallow bow of respect, one dominant wolf to another.
Better.
Not fixed, not anywhere near normal. But he couldn't find it in him to care one way or the other, because now he could find Anna.
I have a lock on her. What's 10 miles in that direction?
Islington, Dedham, Westwood, Milton, maybe? I know my way around here by road, not as the crow flies. We'll have to consult a map to be sure. And how certain are you of the 10 miles?
It's close to that,
Charles said. He considered just getting into a car and following his link, but it would probably be faster if he knew where he was going, as the crow flies directions had some serious issues in a day of fences and roads, especially when he was pretty sure that he could figure out exactly where she was before they left the condo. He hadn't wasted his time today.
Why don't you let the rest of them back in and join me at my computer?
He needed the moment it would take Isaac to assemble the others. Charles was shaking, and dominant enough not to want anyone to see. She was alive. It would be enough for the moment. He sat down at the table and found that his computer had finished the task he'd set for it. He heard them file in, but he didn't turn around. He didn't want to risk meeting anyone's eye unexpectedly until he had Anna safe.
Anna is a nut for police procedurals,
he told them as he resized a window so he could see if he'd made any progress.
This morning she observed that serial killers often like to insinuate themselves into the investigations. I initially dismissed it, because you would have noticed something like that after this many years, right?
We looked, Goldstein said. There was no sign of anything.
His script had done its job, and he was in through the firewalls. It always was good to have friends on the inside. He could talk and hack at the same time, and maybe it would keep the feds from figuring out where he was. It would probably help that none of them had worked for the IRS, and that the back door he'd gotten in through was low on graphics and high on code.
I decided that maybe the initial killer, the old one, maybe he wasn't that kind of psycho, but the new guy might be, the mysterious third man. So I went back 10 years, and I ran a list of the names of everyone involved in the case for all those years. There were 2 people who showed up more than 3 times.
I assure you, I'm not a serial killer, said Goldstein dryly.
I was pretty sure it wasn't you, Charles agreed. You want to catch him so badly I can smell it. So I took a look at the other guy first.
Goldstein drew in a sharp breath.
You can't be serious.
Goldstein had been involved in a number of the investigations, and he would know who else had been there with him.
Someone was present for 6 of the last 10 years,
Charles continued,
giving an interview to the newspaper or the TV news, helping out at the call center, assigned as liaison to someone. And once I looked out and found his photo on the front page paper of where one of the bodies turned up, I was able to confirm that he has been in the right town at the right time for 9 of the last 10 years in a job that usually moves people around. The other year, when he was assigned halfway across the country, he was on a mysterious vacation at the time of the killings. So I went looking into his background, called in a few favors, hacked a few databases, called a couple of police officers, and a retired minister.
"Who is it?" asked Boeckler, an eager bite to his voice. Charles hit a button, and a photo of Cantrip's poster boy came up on half his screen, leaving him to file through records on the other.
According to a former nanny, the good senator was obsessed that his son be a manly man, Texas style. And when the 6-year-old Les Hoyter was discovered playing with his mother's makeup, he was bundled up and sent to spend some manly time with the senator's older brother, the Vietnam War vet and avid hunter, Travis Hoyter, who lived, and still lives, in Vermont. Travis Hoyter also has houses and properties in a number of the cities where the big game hunters' killing sprees have taken place, as well as a good dozen in places that haven't had killings. In the few places our killer has been active and Travis Hoyter doesn't own property, his family owns property, or one of his 3 companies has condos or apartments. He's a little bit crazy, is Travis, so the Hoyter family doesn't let him appear at public functions or on TV because he might not be politically correct in his views.
Hoyter, Goldstein spoke with the barest shadow of Brother Wolf's desire to destroy the killer in his voice. A senator's son. This is going to be a nightmare of political pressures, Leslie said. My boss is going to love it. Charles couldn't tell if she was being sarcastic or not, probably because she didn't know either.
And the nail on the coffin is this. Travis and Senator Dwight Hoyter had a younger sister, Helena. In 1981, when she was 16, she turned up pregnant. Raped, she claimed. She moved in with her big brother and then committed suicide a couple of years later, leaving Travis in charge of her half-blood boy. A retired teacher I talked to told me that the boy was different, not precisely slow or autistic, but definitely odd, with a tendency toward violence. His name is Benedict Hoyter, and he finds menial jobs, according to the IRS.
This had been the last little bit he'd needed to tie it all up in a bow.
And for the last 5 years, he's been doing janitorial work or maintenance, moving every year or so.
Charles backed out of the IRS database and closed his doorway. Then he slid into a chunk of darknet, a separate little space of the internet unseen by search engines, and mostly engineered by hackers who'd abandoned the internet for most of their more questionable pursuits, and pulled up a list of properties from Travis Hoyter's tax records, something he'd copied over during an earlier excursion into the IRS database.
"I don't think you're supposed to be able to get at that information," said Leslie.
"Don't look," said Goldstein, peering over Charles's shoulder. "We don't know anything about illegal hacking." He whistled cheerily.
"Travis Hoyter owns half the world."
Charles searched for Massachusetts and found an address.
"Not that one," murmured Isaac. "That's downtown. You want 10 miles southwest of here. Not that one, that's way up north. There, Dedham. One of my college girlfriends kept a horse out there, and that's about the right direction and distance."
Charles didn't want to be wrong, so he committed that address to memory, but kept going through the records until his search jumped back to the beginning. It was Dedham, or they'd have to follow the bond. Either way, Hoyter was done. Weighing time lost investigating versus lost time, Charles took a moment to look up the address on another darknet site that specialized in property records, official and unofficial. The darknet was a rather tedious mix of conspiracy theorists, brilliant black hats, and OCD record keepers. Travis Hoyter's Dedham property was a largish 2-story farmhouse with a barn on 4.2 acres that had sold 5 years ago for close to $1 million. Charles printed the house plans and the county record of the last survey of the land, folded them, and shoved them into his pocket.
One of my pack has a van waiting for us outside, Isaac said. Shall we go?
Focused on Anna, Charles had forgotten that they would need a car to get there. It was probably best that he not drive.
Chapter 12. Anna was panting with the pain of shifting, and her muscles shook at random for what she told herself was the same reason. She felt weaker than she'd ever been while in wolf form, and she smelled wrong, too. Sick, or drugged, maybe. The other man, the one who was not Les Hoyter, was still ranting in the other room about what he would do to her in very explicit language, which meant that either her shift had been Charles fast, or he had been talking for 15 or 20 minutes. She was betting on the latter. Hoyter encouraged the other man, whose name evidently was Benedict, adding ugly details or making fun of him, whatever it took to goad him to new heights. Hoyter probably thought that she was cowering in the cage, listening.
Do you remember what we did to that girl in Texas? Hoyter asked. The one with the butterfly tattoo?
Not that one, the tall one.
Anna came to her feet and shook like she was throwing water off her fur in an attempt to get her muscles working, and so she would not look as though she was cowering in her cage, afraid of them, before they'd even done anything to her. She did her best to tune them out, turn them into background noise like an unpleasant song on the radio. She needed something else to focus on. Her night vision as a human was pretty good. In her wolf form, it was even better. Her cage hung about 2 feet off of a polished floor that looked more out of place than the cage itself did in the big open room. There was a lingering scent of horses to tell her that this had originally been a barn, but someone had repurposed it into a dance studio. On the far end of the room, on the short wall, a bench held a couple pairs of slip-on shoes and what looked like a belly-dancing coin belt. Next to the bench, one corner of the barn was closed off and a sign that read Office hung on the door. A wall of mirrors spanned the long side of the barn, mirrors that reflected her image, still looking like she was terrified. A long brass bar, placed about 3 feet up and running the length of the mirrored surface, clinched the deal. She was imprisoned in a cage hanging from the rafters of a dance studio. No dungeon or dank hidden basement for her. When she was performing regularly, she used to have nightmares about being imprisoned on a stage, where she would be able to get out only if she played Mary Had a Little Lamb backward, which should have been easy, but someone had replaced her cello strings with violin strings. A cage in a dance studio was better than that, right? Honest terror, instead of frustrated embarrassment. She had to get out of here. But in the meantime, she needed to do something about the frightened-looking werewolf reflected in the big mirror. She stood up straighter and pricked her ears, and the mirror Anna appeared slightly less pathetic. She didn't quite manage scary. Charles could do that without even trying. But at least she didn't look so scared. She was a werewolf. She was not a victim. Seeing that they had brought her to a barn-turned-dance studio, Anna wondered if there was any connection to Lizzie. Maybe she had danced or taught here. Maybe this was how the killers had found her. Or maybe Boakler and his daughter were simply on Cantrip's mysterious and sometimes inaccurate list of Fae and others living in the United States, a list Hoyter would have access to. But if there was a link between Lizzie and this dance studio, there was a slight chance that Charles could make the connection and find her. Because he had to know she was gone by now. If he hadn't contacted her through their bond, then he couldn't. He'd have to find another way, and the dance studio might lead him here in a couple of months or so. And now she looked pathetic again. There was a sharp smacking sound, like someone getting slapped in the face, a second smack, and the background noise of the men fantasizing about torture and rape stopped abruptly.
You know what I told you,
an old man's voice, a little quavery but still powerful, spoke in almost soft tones that reminded Anna of Bran when he got really angry.
You keep using those words,
and you're gonna forget and use them in public. Then you'll lose your nice job and find yourself out in the streets begging for bread because I'm not going to feed you. No child of my house will be useless and living off the dole.
Someone said,
"Yes, sir,"
in an almost whisper.
"Those words are for trash,"
the old man continued,
"for low-born scum. Your father might have been scum, but your mother was a good girl, and her blood should be stronger. You shame her when you speak that way."
The old man's voice changed a little, as if he'd moved, but also sharpened.
"And you, Les, what do you think you're doing? Do you think I don't know where he gets it? You think you're so damn smart, but you are nothing, nothing. Too stupid for the FBI, too pansy-ass for the military. You like to forget who is in charge here, or what our mission is and what it means. Distraction is not useful. You know how hard he has to work to seem just like everyone else. You want him to get caught? How far would you get trying to destroy the creatures who were taking over this land of ours without Benedict? Are you trying to ruin us?"
"No, sir." Hoyter's voice was subdued, but there was venom lurking below the meek tones. "Sorry, Uncle Travis."
"You aren't a kid anymore,"
the old man said sternly, apparently missing the undercurrents in the younger man's attitude.
"Start acting like it. What are we doing here?"
"Saving our country." Hoyter's voice strengthened, almost military style, and he was telling the truth. "Making our country safe for her citizens by taking out the trash and doing the things that our government is too liberal, too soft to do." Anna couldn't fathom it. She remembered his little speech at their lunch yesterday. He'd been telling the truth as he believed it then, and though she'd thought him unlikable, she'd also felt a certain respect for him. She should have remembered Brand's law. Zealots are one-trick ponies. They love nothing so much as their own cause. Don't get in their way without expecting to be hurt. She'd always thought Brand had been talking about himself. But she knew better, even if he didn't. Brand was driven, but he loved his sons, and he loved his pack. He was not a one-trick pony.
"Do you remember the little girl that we hung by her braid while we..."
The lust in Hoyter's voice as he'd urged the unseen Benedict on to a greater frenzy was more real than the sincere speech he'd given her at the lunch table. Hoyter wasn't a zealot either, she decided. He only said he was protecting America from monsters to make himself believe that he was in the right as he satisfied his lust for power over others, his desire to cause other people pain and suffering. Murder and rape were his real cause. Keeping America safe was only an excuse.
"Can I have her first, Uncle Travis?"
Benedict asked.
"I like the girls better, and her husband hurt me. Can I have her first?"
"That's better, boy,"
the older man said.
"You keep your language polite. Let's go take a look at her before we decide anything. We'll have a while to play before you get to feed on her death. There will be time enough for everything."
He sounded like he was talking about going fishing instead of torturing and killing someone. The door near her cage opened, and the old man turned on the light as they all walked in. "Hail, hail, the gang's all here," she thought, as she got her first good look at her captors. Even knowing what she did, Les Hoyter still looked sort of all-American, like the kind of guy who helped little old ladies cross the street. The other young man, Benedict Hoyter, he was big, taller than Charles, and maybe 50 pounds heavier, and Charles wasn't a beanpole. There was something wrong with his eyes, and he smelled like a deer in rut. She found it uncomfortable to meet his eyes, and she could stare down Bran. It had nothing to do with dominance, and everything to do with the madness in his face. The features were different, but Benedict's expression, the thoughts that lurked behind his eyes, were classic Justin, the crazy werewolf who'd changed her and
done all the other things that no one else had particularly wanted to do to an Omega Wolf. Not long after she and Charles met, Charles had killed Justin. But even years later, she had nightmares about Justin's eyes. Because Benedict made her so uneasy, she turned her attention to the other stranger in the mix. Clearly related by blood to both of the younger two, the old man, Uncle Travis, that was what Hoyter had called him, showed her what Hoyter would look like in 40 years, assuming he didn't die under her fangs as she hoped. Age had not so much bent this man as clarified him. Hoyter still looked a little soft around the edges. It was what gave him his wholesome appearance. This man was all rawhide and leather. Even in his mid-60s or early 70s, he was good-looking, with bright blue eyes unfaded by the years and sharp, clean features that might have been spectacular when he was young, but had been solidified by a sense of strength and determination. If Anna thought that the strength of character in his face was slightly mad, well, she was in a better place than most to make that judgment. He moved like there was muscle under his skin despite his age, and from the body language of the others, she knew that here was the Alpha Wolf. He ruled by fiat, by strength of character, and by their understanding that it was this one who kept them safe and gave them direction, and would kill them if he needed to. The body language she observed when the older man wasn't looking at his minions also told her that Hoyter chafed at his secondary position. He was ready to take over at the first sign of weakness. It had been in his voice, too. The old man should have known. And that he didn't signaled to Anna that he was weakening and would not rule here much longer.
"Let's have a look at you, darling,"
the old man crooned as he came up to the cage, seemingly unfazed by her change to wolf.
"Black as pitch and ice blue eyes. I've never seen a wolf with blue eyes before."
She had to fight not to back away. Close up, he smelled of pipe tobacco. Charles sometimes smelled like that after he performed one of the ceremonies his grandfather had taught him. Charles didn't do one often, but she'd learned to see the signs. He'd get restless for a few days, then he'd head off to the woods on his own, or haul her off with him, to find a place to burn tobacco and sing to the spirits in his mother's tongue. Sometimes he'd tell her what he was doing. Sometimes he wouldn't. She didn't ask him about the rocks he'd bring in, or the small bits of cloth he'd set on top of them during certain seasons of the year. He told her once that some things were to be shared, and others were not. And that was good enough for her. But Charles's tobacco scent had come to be comforting. She resented the old man for ruining it.
"Uncle Travis, she's a wolf."
Benedict's voice was a whine better suited to a teenager arguing for a later curfew than the grown man he was. Anna was sure by now there was something wrong with him, something more than his being a sociopathic, or was that psychopathic, serial killer.
"She's no good as a wolf. I don't like old men or boys, but I can do them. I won't do a wolf. That's just sick."
"Hush," said the old man. "They can't stay wolves forever. Tomorrow's the full moon. She can stay a wolf through that, but then she'll have to change back when the moon sets."
He was wrong. As long as she didn't mind losing herself to the wolf, she could stay in wolf shape indefinitely. But he sounded very confident. Maybe Cantrip's databases had inaccurate information about more than simply who was and was not Fae.
"I can't wait until tomorrow," said Hoyter. "You're not a werewolf," Benedict said. "You don't need the full moon to do anything."
"No, I don't care about the moon," Hoyter smiled. "I can't wait to see that smug bastard lose it, because we have his wife, and he can't find her."
"You aren't going anywhere near him,"
Uncle Travis snapped irritably.
"Don't be stupid. You get cocky, and he'll smell it on you. Smell her on you, maybe."
He didn't take his attention off Anna, so he didn't see the resentment that flashed and disappeared on Hoyter's face. Anna didn't have Charles's memory for information, but she was pretty sure that Hoyter was nearly 30.
That was old to be taking orders issued as if he were a child. Werewolves had to follow their alpha's orders that way, though. They followed them, or they were killed. Maybe it was the same kind of thing for Hoyter? Maybe his uncle read him better than she did, and the threat of death was enough to keep him in line.
"You look so meek in there,"
Uncle Travis said, and it took a moment for Anna to process that he was talking to her, because he'd switched from talking to Hoyter without altering his voice or his body posture.
"Are you afraid, princess? You should be. Your kind is trying to take over the world. You don't fool me with the weird good guys spin doctoring. I know a predator when I see one. It's just like the gays, just like the gooks and the spicks and the dagos trying to turn this country into a cesspool."
Gooks were Vietnamese, right? Score one for her high school history class because she'd never actually heard that one out loud before. Spicks were Hispanic. She had no idea who the Dagos were. Her racist vocabulary obviously needed work. What would a racist call werewolves? Wargs? She kind of liked that one, but suspected that racist bastards didn't read Tolkien. Or, if they did, she didn't want to know about it.
"But we're here to stop you,"
Uncle Travis said, then smiled seductively. And he was handsome enough that she would bet that a lot of women had followed that smile into a bedroom.
"And for payment, all we ask is that we have a little fun along the way."